Welcome back, baseball fans, to episode 7 of the Joshua Kuznick Experience. I am your host, Ryan Sullivan, editor-in-chief of NatsGM.com and the Baron of All Baseball Podcasts. And as always, I am joined by the man the show is named after, MLB certified agent and Nirvana's number one fan, Joshua Kuznick. Josh, how are you, man? It's been a while.
Good, busy. Trying to close up the season on a good note and get ready for all the off-season work.
Yeah, now maybe that's a great place to start and to give a little bit of an insight into the audience of, you know, what is an agent doing this time of year? You know, September, the season, I don't know, we have about a week left, give or take, when everybody's downloading this. Kind of what is an agent doing at this time of year?
The minor league season ended a few weeks ago, so had to close out the MILB season, figure out my six-year free agents that I have to handle, figuring out which guys are going to free agency or staying with their ball clubs. I'm in negotiations now with a few clubs trying to retain some six-year guys. Also trying to figure out who is going on the 40-man and who isn't. Then I just got back from Dallas for an MLBPA meeting. That was a fun trip. I literally flew out from West Palm Beach and landed in Dallas at 3 in the morning, got into town at 3 a.m., stayed 20 miles away from the airport, drove back 20 miles to the airport where the hotel was, and was there for a 10 a.m. meeting that lasted till 4, and then flew home at 8 and got back at 3 in the morning.
Life is an agent, right? Life is an agent.
Yeah, that was fun, and then in November there's another meeting, and then December's the winter meetings, and just lots of stuff going on. Plus, some teams have their instructs going on now, so I had to get that stuff straightened out. And about 3 weeks ago, I don't remember if we talked about it, but Mr. Jeffress was in town, and got to spend 3 good days with him before his birthday, and that was cool. He got some neat autographs from Marlin guys. He got stuff signed by Giancarlo Stanton, Ichiro, and D. Gordon, who he's friends with. So that was cool. It's always fun seeing guys, you know, be fans of the guys that they get to play with. And, you know, that was neat. And, you know, always getting to see guys like Jeremy's always fun. So that was the last of my big league work. Clevinger was in town in Tampa, but I happened to be sick that week. I just had a cold and it was pouring, so this didn't work out. But minor league stuff is pretty much over, with the exception of the instruct stuff. And big league season's winding down and just getting ready for all the other stuff in the postseason.
All right, you gave me a bunch there that I kind of want to talk about. First of all, what do you do at Instructs? Are you going to look at potential clients? Are you meeting with your client? What are you doing at Instructs?
Seeing guys I have playing first and foremost, and then trying to see if there's anybody I like and you know, possibly want to sign. I'm really not in recruiting mode right now. I'm pretty happy with the guys that I have, so I'm really not looking to take too many guys on right now. I'm pretty much at max capacity, with the obvious exception if there's somebody that I happen to find that's just, you know, really good and a really good dude. I'm really not, you know, if I stumble across something, that'd be great, but not really in full-blown scouting mode. It's really taking care of the guys that I already have.
And how many guys do you have now?
Somewhere around 20, 19, 20.
And is that, you use the word max capacity, is that about the max you could handle kind of as a one-person
job?
I
couldn't do my job if I had more guys than that. I've had every amount of players possible in my career. I mean, back when I first started, I think I had 110 guys, and then 3 years ago, I was down to 12, and it's like, well, damn it, I gotta, you know, that's too far off the spectrum, gotta go out and sign guys, and I'm 13. The first three guys I signed were Carlos Osuahe, Seth Lugo, and Tyler White.
Well, give a. That's a perfect segue. What's going on with those three guys?
Seth is coming to Florida for the Mets training program that they run over at the facility. So hopefully that bodes well for his 40-man prospects. If not, I would imagine he's a good Rule 5 prospect. He led the Mets minor leagues in strikeouts this year, which, you know, it's not some small feat for anyone, much less a 33rd rounder. I mean, that was just such a cool story all year. Seth, he was the leading relief pitcher in strikeouts last year in the Florida State League, and then this year He led the whole organization in strikeouts, and he got all the way up to AAA, and he looks great. I mean, he was a guy that I remember. He was the first guy I signed in 13, and I happened to see him behind my house. I was just walking around the field one day, and I'm watching him throw, and good God, like, who's this guy? And usually when you have that moment, I mean, I've had that moment 100 times in my career where I'm watching a guy throw, and he turns around, it's like, oh, no, it's Syndergaard.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Walk away. But no, with Lugo, he's 33rd round pick, and I'm like, did he get $1 million? Like, no, he got nothing. He doesn't have an agent. I'm like, well, that's very strange. So, you know, that was a cool story. And then Tyler, I think, was on MILB.com. He got named the PCL postseason MVP and just had a ridiculous video game number year. And I think he had like an 1100 OPS and went from the GCL to AAA in 2 years, 2.5 years.
Wow.
Mm. And Mr. Swahe, a week from Wednesday, will be going to the Arizona Fall League.
Oh, okay. Good for him. Wow.
Which I noticed I did not mention that because I don't like the Fall League.
Yeah. Well, once again, perfect segue. Why?
As an agent, I just, every agent on earth is at the Fall League, and I don't want to get caught up in that derby of just jockeying for guys right to get, you know, right before they get to the big leagues. I've never done that, and I used to go to the Fall League every year, and it's like I hated myself, and I don't like the Fall League. I mean, I don't mind going for the baseball, but and if one of my guys was there and wanted me to go, like Carlos, I'd have no problem going. But you know, that whole just going for recruiting and camping out there for a month, I hate that stuff. And I remember years ago when you know I was starting out, I panic whenever a guy would get named to the Fall League because I'd have to fend off the guys in the Fall League. You know, hopefully not getting fired.
So that's poaching central, I guess, is what you're saying.
I think it happens there more than anywhere because you have the best prospects in baseball all in one spot for a few months, and it's just people make multiple trips out there. It's just something that happens, and I'm not a part of that. I don't like that, and I've always felt that you really can't build that kind of relationship you want to have with your client and do that effective job if you literally just get them right before they get to the big leagues. I mean, don't get me wrong, if I didn't have an agent, was in the big leagues or was looking for one and didn't have one or was going to fire his guy and I got a call, then sure, I would investigate it like anybody else. But going out there and trying to get somebody else fired, I don't really do that. I haven't done that in years. It was one of the things that I didn't like doing, and I just don't do it anymore.
Well, and if that player's willing to dump somebody when they're that close to the major leagues, they're probably willing to dump you again or what have you. So
that is a very good point, and I definitely believe that. That's an icky feeling because if you get a guy right before he gets to the big leagues and he dumps the guy he's been with forever, you know, right before the guy gets to arbitration, then you're going to get fired most likely. You know, or even if you don't get fired, you know, there's always the possibility of you doing a really good job and then you make one mistake and then you're gone. You know, they're just looking for a reason to go. And then if they can't find a reason to go, you know, I've heard every reason in the world over the years. And my favorite one's like, I don't really have a good reason. I'm just going to do it. It's like, all right, cool. At least I did my job.
Right. So jumping back a second, you said that you're negotiating six-year free agent contracts or minor league free agent contracts now. Mm-hmm. What kind of negotiation is that? I mean, is there real leverage? I mean, what is that like? Are you trying to find the best spot for your player?
No. Those guys aren't free agents. These are just talking to the club that they're with. The guys that want to retain the guys but don't necessarily want to put them on the 40-man. It's like any other negotiation. It's pretty similar to the draft where you're negotiating different things, but the tone is similar.
What kind of leverage do you have in those negotiations if they're not really free agents?
Free agency.
Oh, okay. So, I misunderstood when you said that. Okay. So.
Yeah. So, you know, the guys who were about to enter free agency on the minor league side, I mean, you see minor league free agents get signed all the time, get big league invites, and teams want to keep some of those guys and not necessarily spend the 40-man spot on them. And, you know, they'll sign a minor league deal or go to free agency and try to find something better. But for me, I've always found that I'd like to get all my minor league free agency finished before the Rule 5 draft. So the player's at least eligible to get picked in the Rule 5 draft. So if you have a guy that multiple teams are interested in, then and he can't get a major league deal somewhere else, or with the club that he's with, it's not a bad idea to get him signed up before the Rule 5 draft in case there were other teams interested in, and they're like, you know what, we've got a roster spot, it's December, why not?
Makes sense. Okay, and are you talking like third catchers at the AAA level kind of players? Is that...
Somewhat, but, you know, you always run into minor league free agents like, you know, Dave Chapman, who was a big leaguer, got hurt, signed with the Brewers at Indy Ball, and then just dominated this year. And I thought he made a pretty compelling case to get to the big leagues this year. It didn't happen for him because the Brewers bullpen is actually pretty good. No, he was really good. Like,
no, yeah, absolutely.
Aside from Jeffress, it was really good, and there just wasn't room for Jay. And, you know, I would imagine they'd love to bring him back with the year he had. I think in AAA he led the team in saves, and he was only there from June on. And in the PCL in Colorado Springs, he had like a 3 ERA and a 1.8 on the road. And then in AA, when he first came back, he had like a 0.4 and was a Southern League All-Star. And, you know, so that's the kind of guy you're looking at, bullpen arms. You know, don't forget, you know, Jeremy Jeffress was, you know, would have been a 6-year free agent had he not been put on the 40-man by the Brewers.
That's a good point. That's a great point.
You know, and if you don't come to terms with a ball club about a 6-year guy, and they want to keep them, you know, you can just say, no, 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 we're not taking the money, we don't like your offer, we want to get a new organization. Then you just put him on the 40-man, and then he doesn't become a free agent.
Yeah, that's a good point, too. Yeah.
Which is good, because, you know, that's like the least threatening threat ever. You know, if he doesn't sign this, we're putting him on the major league roster. All right, cool.
I'll have my cake and eat it, too, thank you.
Yeah, I've had that happen where it's like, it's usually you're talking about the 40th man on the 40-man in
right.
Those cases. So, you know, it's just one of those things. But, you know, it's interesting. It's not that dissimilar to the draft. You know, you have to negotiate certain things like opt-out dates, big league invites to spring training or not, the money, guaranteed dollars. So much stuff you have to negotiate on the contract side of things, in addition to doing all your analytical work to figure out what the best spot is for your client. You know, should he stay where he is? Should he go somewhere else? If he goes somewhere else, where is he going? You have to pay attention to the guys coming up behind him with every organization and the guys that are ahead of him, and you just got to know what you're doing, because many guys have screwed up their careers by just making a bad decision when it comes to their careers or during 6-year free agency. And these are guys that, had they stayed where they were, probably would have had big league careers, but they go somewhere else and they're just discarded immediately. So you got to be careful with it. You know, you don't want to make any, you don't ever want to give a guy bad advice. So it's really important, like anything else that we do. So it's just until 5 days after the World Series, I can only talk to the ball club that they're with, and then 5 days after the World Series, they become free agents.
That's really insightful. I never knew, you know, nearly as much about that. That's very cool. Interesting, anyway.
I'm glad we got to talk about that.
Yeah. Because
Saved by the Bell.
Well, I don't know. I know more about Saved by the Bell anyways. That might be more interesting.
Yeah. We should just try to segue Kevin the Robot into every episode.
The worst character ever. You guys forgot Screech's birthday.
That's my favorite episode, I think, ever.
I don't know.
Because
I think
they treated him like a member of the crew. It's like, hey, Kevin.
Right. He was just hanging around school.
You know what's funny is we're so old now that we're like 2 generations removed from those robots. But like, as a kid in our age bracket, people forget that somebody had a remote control commanding that robot. Like, that wasn't an automated, that wasn't a Terminator. It had a remote control.
Right.
So for the show to ask us to suspend that disbelief, either they were really forward-thinking writers knowing that there'd be a time where people didn't remember the remote control, or they were just like, I don't care.
Oh, no. They thought the audience was the dumbest group of people of all time. I mean, Zach would just call a timeout, and all of a sudden everything would stop. I mean, no problem.
You know, I don't mind the timeout nearly as much as that there's no, and I know this is a lot to ask about the show, but there is not. I always loved that there was never any continuity on the show. I mean that by whatever hijinks they got into at the school never carried over to the next episode. Where there was no, it was never self-referential. It's like, hey, remember when Screech could tell the future? Like, that never happened.
Yeah, the only thing that they did keep continuity with was who was dating who. That was about the only thing.
Who was dating who, and they always had, like, you know, remember how Kelly's dad got fired?
Yeah.
And they were broke? Well, my answer to that always was, if I had a daughter and her school had, like, 97 dances a year, she broke too from buying all those dresses.
Right, that is very true. Zach and Kelly's prom, just the worst.
Oh, how many dancers do you think were on Saved by the Bell statistically compared to how many episodes there were?
Oh, God. I mean, you know, I went to high school and we had two dances a year, prom and homecoming, and they had more Sadie Hawkins dance, the heart thing.
Yeah, Winter solstice dance.
This is the heart around the neck dance. Yes.
This is the hillbilly dance from Hee Haw. Like, what?
Oh, well, now it's time for the Zack Attack to perform at this month's dance. Yeah.
That might be my favorite episode when he was Vanilla Ice. That was awesome.
Hi, the music with Casey Kasem. Oh, God.
Interesting trivia note. Casey Kasem episode, the first episode in Saved by the Bell history after they moved from saving the Good Morning, Miss Bliss.
Is that right?
That is. That's the first episode, the Casey Kasem one.
I can't believe that, really.
I couldn't believe it either, because...
It feels like that was way more in the middle of the season, or the season. Right,
they just pick up, like, we're supposed to know all the characters.
Amazing.
They're like, Screech is doing stupid things. Like, I don't know who Screech is.
Right. Oh, but and Slater all of a sudden is a race car driver. Oh, who's Slater? You know?
I still like when they tried to tackle adult theme thing to Saved by the Bell. They're like, we're going to do a drinking and driving episode.
Oh.
Or we're going to do a No Hope with Dope episode.
Oh, with Johnny,
Johnny Rockstar.
Yeah, God, I forget his name, and that's going to drive me crazy.
By the way, you know, he was dating Tiffany Amber Thiessen, and that's how he got the role for that. I hate knowing that.
Yeah, I did. I actually did know that, which just makes me really depressed
about life. My favorite part of that episode...
Johnny Dakota. That's what his name was.
Johnny Dakota. Oh, my God. The points for you.
Yes.
My favorite part of the Johnny Dakota episode had to be when they're in the group session talking about how bad drugs are, and they have to talk about Len Bias. And it was like, what?
Yeah.
But these are really devoted basketball high school kids.
Yeah, really and truly.
Like, that was before Google. Like, how did they all know the details about Len Bias's overdose?
Oh, wow. Yeah, another good part of that.
I'm glad we're laughing about this, because it was such a horrible thing in sports, but Saved by the Bell made it awful. More awful.
Oh, God. Okay. Oh. All right, let me try
I'm glad we could fit Len Bias into our podcast.
Len Bias, University of Maryland, man. Near and dear to my heart. Absolutely. Sad.
Do you remember Celtics fans actually wanted a do-over after he died? I'm like, doesn't work that way.
Well, and not 3 or 4 years later, Reggie Lewis died of a cardiac arrest.
That was horrible. And the worst, I mean, they were both preventable. Reggie Lewis's was infinitely preventable because they diagnosed him with the heart problem and said, listen, don't play basketball anymore. And then he did it.
He was like, you know what? Yeah, I don't think that's going to work. Yeah.
Athletes don't die ever. Although, I think we may have talked about this. I don't remember if we deleted it. The worst death-related sports thing by a sports team ever, for my money, is definitely what the New York Rangers did. Like, did I talk to you about this ever?
No, this is new ground we're covering.
This is the worst management
thing
ever.
Should I just hit the edit button right now?
No. This is public. Like, we're good. Like, I'm fine leaving this in there. It's hockey, which I don't care. But the New York Rangers had a first-round pick that was supposed to be, like, the second coming of Pavel Bure. And his name was Alexander Cherepanov. He was first-round pick. He was this great Russian prospect, like, big-time goal scorer. I mean, he was terrific.
I remember the name, yeah.
Cherepanov played in Russia in the KHL when Yaromir Yager was over there for his hiatus of 5 years, which cost him the goal scoring record. Which, by the way, Yager's still playing, which is awesome. But Cherepanov, he died on the ice. He had a defective like heart valve, and he died during a game at 19 years old, which awful tragedy. And anyway, the Rangers, like, a year later, after everything finally subsided, people were moving on, and you know, it's always going to be terrible, but, you know, people finally were starting to get over it. The Rangers petitioned the NHL to get a compensatory draft
pick. I remember this.
First round pick, and they won! They got a second round pick, because in the NHL, if you don't sign your first round pick, you get a second round pick. And the Rangers were like, well, we didn't sign our first rounder, he's dead. And they gave him a second round pick!
Well,
can you imagine it? Do you think baseball would do that? Like, if somebody got drafted in the first round and they're like, oh, he was unsigned, we're going to get a top pick.
I would not like to be the front office guy that had to send that fax to the league office.
I would never. I no, ever. I mean, can you imagine that? That would be so, I mean, it's horrible as it is. It would be, they would make an intern do that. Except with the Rangers, it was Glenn Sather, who was like 75 years old, won like 8 Stanley Cups. He didn't care.
Yeah, he could completely care less. He was like, look at my rings, brother. No problem.
I mean, it would be akin to, like, you know, Tony La Russa sending that back. He would do it.
Yeah, well, he could care less, too. But in a bizarre way, this kind of gives me a chance to transition to a topic I wanted to talk to you about, and I can't believe I can say that. But
untimely death?
Well, I'm not going quite that far, but what I did want to get to is kind of where an agent's role is in protecting his player. Particularly, I have in mind Matt Harvey a few weeks ago with Scott Boras, and I don't want to put you on the spot to comment on that, obviously, because it's...
I don't comment about the corporation.
Right, and nor am I really asking you to, but it...
I know you're not.
But it got me thinking a little bit about where that line is of when do you step in to get involved, at least publicly versus privately, and have you had kind
you
of
always,
a, go ahead, yeah.
No, you always got to. I mean, you always try to do it diplomatically behind the scenes first. But I mean, it wasn't really an injury thing. But I think we've been referencing it all season. But I'm sure you remember what I went through in spring training with the Orioles, and you know, I reached a point with Steve where Clevinger, where I just had enough, and I had to do what was best for the player. And I'm sure the team wasn't thrilled about that. But you know, at the end of the day, you got to do what's best for your client. You have to. That's what you sign up for. So. If the team is resistant to what your idea and your player's idea, if they're resistant to what you got, you know, the agent player team feels like is the best course of action, and the team is just resistant to it and they don't want to talk to you about it, there's really nothing else to do other than, you know, either sit idly by or talk to somebody in the media and put your name on it. I mean, obviously not anonymously, but I actually... breaking my vow here, I don't have a huge problem about what the agent did in that case. I mean, as a fan, it sucked, but I would do the same thing. If I had that kind of player, I got to be looking out for his whole career. I can't just look at a month. And yeah, it's terrible. Postseason is awful timing, but if this was an innings limit that was prescribed back in March and the team knew, I mean, this shouldn't have been a surprise. And the thing I think people forget is that these were guidelines that were established by the doctor, from my understanding, the club's doctor and Harvey's doctor, like back in March, and everybody was on board. The team was on board, the manager was on board, and when they became contenders, it became an issue. So I don't think that's fair. My only opinion, which I don't know if I should weigh this, but whatever, you can edit. I don't have a problem as the agent speaking out, but when, I guess, Harvey wrote that article in the Player Tribune, I would not have recommended that.
Yeah, and I think that was not the best move for him. I think in some ways it's best to just let the agent take the fall there rather than put his name on it.
Yeah, exactly. I don't understand why. I mean, I'm not going to tell any player what to do, and if they really want to do that, that's on them, but I wouldn't have advised that. It came off probably not, in my opinion, as how he intended it to come out, which is always the danger when you're writing stuff, as I have learned in the past myself.
Well, and I will say Harvey is somewhat of a unique situation. I mean, everything has kind of come together in a cluster F, so to speak. I mean, you know, this team was not expected to be that great, and somehow the combination of the Nationals being awful and the Mets overachieving like crazy this year has found them in the playoff chase, and you know,
Harvey, I don't know if they're overachieving, though, man. I said this in spring training. I live in St. Lucie. I don't know if there's any better pitching I've seen in baseball all year from 1 to 5. And they've got guys that would be 3-4 starters sitting in AAA. I mean, Lugo, just to segue back to me again, because that's what everything's about.
Well, it is the name Lugo, Joshua Kuznick Experience, yes.
Lugo would be a 5-star for pretty much every team in baseball but the Mets. So, you know, that's tough, but, you know, their pitching's so freaking good. I mean, Dylan G's in the minors, that's how good their pitching is.
Yeah,
so,
Dylan G can't pitch against the Nationals 15 times a year either, so, you know.
Yeah, I mean, but he was a good pitcher for a long time. Making $5 million, and that guy's sitting in AAA because their young guys are just so good. And before the year, I was on the – I've always been a big – fan of Steven Matz. I watched him in A-ball, and I thought he was the best. I thought he was the best guy out of the whole group. Now, obviously, he's not Matt Harvey, but I like Matz the best out of all of them because he's a lefty. But, Syndergaard, Harvey, I mean, this is like Isringhausen, Pulsifer, and Wilson 2.0, except not injury-prone guys for now. Although, to be fair, Matz, Harvey have both had TJ, so.
Yeah.
You know, at least that's behind them.
That, well, yeah, we hope, anyways. But, and back to the point, though, you know, and he's a unique situation that he's a couple of years away from a $200 to $300 million contract. This isn't a guy that's, you know, hey, at his best, he's going to get a, you know, a decent contract. I mean, this is an elite of the elite type player.
Yeah, you can make the argument he's, what, top 5 pitcher in baseball? I mean, he's been, you know.
Certainly top 10 good. Without even blinking. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, top 10 without blinking, and then, you know, you can make a pretty good argument top 5. But then, you know, you have guys like Arrieta and Greinke popped up. Well, Greinke's always been there, but, like, Arrieta turned into Greg Maddux this year. And, you know, Greinke having that Bob Gibson-like year. And Kershaw, Sale, you know, Jose Fernandez. And not to play revisionist history because I hate doing this, but how crazy is it that the Mets took Brandon Nimmo over one pick ahead of Jose Fernandez? And by the way, I love Brandon Nimmo.
So do I. Yeah.
Good God. Can you imagine if Jose Fernandez was in that rotation?
Well, and they missed on a couple. Was Sonny Gray in that draft too? I mean, he was 5 or 6 picks later as well. If I've got the year right, I mean.
Yeah, you did. It was Sonny Gray, Fernandez, and yeah. They did a great job scouting Nimmo. He didn't have a high school team. He had to play like travel ball because
there's like no baseball in New Mexico or wherever he was from. I mean, it was not
New Mexico. What was it? Wyoming.
Yeah, it was Wyoming. Pardon me. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he had no high school baseball in the state. It's like what?
Yeah, and he goes in the first round, and everyone, he looked terrible in the GCL, and then he came back to high A, and I loved him. He was my favorite prospect in the league when he was here. He just was so good, consistently good, and then I'm like, wow, he was really good. And then I saw Conforto play this year. I was like, wow, he's even better. So,
yeah, and I think that's a good point. We're not bringing that. Maybe we're kind of circling around about the Mets, but they've done a great job drafting and developing the last few years. I mean, yeah, Harvey's great.
Oh, my
great,
God.
But what about DeGrom and Matz,
I don't
like you
know
say?
Any,
and,
well, I don't know any ball club that could have created the pitching prospects that they did at the trade deadline and not hurt their system at all.
Yeah, I mean, I still think Fulmer's going to come back and bite him a little bit, but you make that trade every day with how Cespedes has played.
I don't think that'll... that's sort of the... Yeah, and to segue back to me, I don't think the Brewers are losing sleep about trading Brantley for Sabathia.
Right. Well, that's true, too. And Brantley's so, maybe the best player nobody talks about in baseball. Probably is the best player in baseball nobody talks about.
And I don't think they... you know, the Brewers would never undo that trade. And, you know, and again, with the Brewers the next year, they traded Escobar, Odorizzi, Kane, and Jeffress for Zach Greinke for 2 years. And I don't think they would undo that either.
Yeah.
I mean, now they probably would because Greinke's not there. But those two and a half years he was there, he was great in Milwaukee, and they needed something for Sabathia. But, you know, I mean, it was a good trade for both teams.
And the
Greinke trade.
And the Shields for Will Myers deal, that deal, would, you know, Kansas City wouldn't undo that either, and they were crushed for that
deal.
No,
yeah. There's no way they would undo that trade. And you know, Kansas City's, you know, you can make the argument. I mean, it's not in Toronto, too. Kansas City's, nobody would, I'm sorry, let me go back. Kansas City's probably the most exciting team in baseball to watch, and, you know, this side of Toronto. So, They really did a good job with the player development, too, and making smart trades, and the Mets have done the same thing. So, I mean, the Mets are great to watch. And
Dayton Moore and Sandy Alderson were two guys that could have been fired 2 years ago as well. It's pretty amazing. Certainly Dayton Moore.
Yeah, it's nuts, and it'll be interesting to see who fills those GM roles that are open right now, because actually all the candidates.
And without speaking on that, do you think we're going to see a lot of transition? I mean, we've already seen three or four jobs open up. We could see, and I'm not trying to put anybody on the spot, but we could see something open up in Washington. We could see, you know, Florida could open up. There are a lot of places that could open. Are we going to see a busy offseason with managers and GMs?
I think so. General manager-wise, I think the Nationals and Marlins are going to stay the same, in my opinion. But, I think there's going to be a lot of turnover. It'll be interesting to see if they go the route that the Brewers took and took a young guy who's, you know, rising star in the industry and give him that position, or if they go the route of a seasoned veteran, and not to use the phrase badly, but like retread, and go that route. So it'll be interesting to see if they go for the older than the new. And I don't include guys like Dombrowski in that retread.
Right.
But, you know what I mean, the guys that have never really won anything and they just keep getting GM shots.
Yeah, I saw that, not to put him in the same category, but I saw DePoto, looks like he's going to be offered the Seattle job just before we started recording this.
Really? That's awesome.
Yeah, I thought I would have put money on Sherrington ended up in Seattle. That was my thought.
Oh, man, we're recording. We can edit this out, right?
I'm just going to hit pause. So, yeah, I guess it's going to be a busy winter with the GM openings. But I thought the DePoto rumor to Seattle was interesting anyways. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, next place I want to go to a little bit is you wrote a column, I don't know exactly how long ago, it's been a little while since we've recorded, about David Herndon, a former client of yours.
Yes.
And it was a pretty good story. I just wanted to kind of give you the floor to talk about him a little bit, because I don't think we've covered him in the past.
Yeah, it was a rough year for Dave. That really sucked. That was unfortunate what happened there. What do you want me to touch on?
Just kind of the whole, just fill in. I don't know how many people read the story at Baseball Perspective, so I'd love to kind of give you the floor, just talk about the whole situation, because it was a terrible, not tragedy, but it was terrible what happened to him.
It was unfortunate because he retired 12 days short of arbitration, which that's painful. He was close to, Super 2 eligible and got non-tendered while he was recovering from Tommy John surgery, and he got signed by the Yankees, played there for 2 years, had a bone bruise last season, was the highest paid non-40-man player in the minor league, which high-fived me for that one. And only took like six innings last year, and this offseason he got signed by the Brewers, was released pretty quickly in spring training, and unfortunately couldn't get picked up anywhere else. Played indie ball for a little while, hurt his arm, and that's all she wrote. That sucks, man. Like I've known him a long time, probably 9-10 years, and got to have a baby in a couple weeks, and just. You know, really good dude, and did a lot for me in my career. Just that's the crappy part of the job is when you see a guy get there and stay there for three straight seasons, and then just have it go away. It's just an awful thing to watch. I mean, as an agent, it's terrible.
Without getting too personal with David's situation, what is he up to now?
Looking for a job, coaching, or trying to become a scout, I think. I don't think he really wants to get into scouting. I believe he's looking for a pitching coach job, but that's not an easy transition either, because there aren't exactly a million jobs available. So it's tough. I mean, we'll see. I've had my early guys transition over to the coaching side. Chuck Caulfield was a client of mine for 6-7 years, and now he's the hitting coach for the Brewers. Low A, and I think he'll be going to high A this year, so it's possible, but I don't know. Some guys are meant for coaching, and some guys are better at playing, so we'll see how that goes, and if he's able to get a job and transition over to that side, but we'll see.
God, that's a shame, because, and the truth is, he's probably financially better off just being a private lesson, you know, pitching coach to high school and grade school kids than trying to get a coaching job in, you know, the minor leagues or professional baseball.
I would imagine so, but it's also hard to get away from that lifestyle when you've been in it for 10 years. So, you know, all of his 20s were spent playing pro baseball, and three of those years were in the major leagues. So, you know, I had a guy years ago, Carlos Martinez, who made the Marlins out of spring training from A-ball to the big leagues, and he was penciled in as a closer and just had this string of injuries, had Tommy John surgery, got 2 years of service, and then finally got released, and no one ever signed him after 2008. That was it.
Now, does your role with them still continue? I mean, do you try to help them get, you know, regular person jobs? And I'm using air quotes, even though you can't see it because we're on a podcast, but... Or is kind of the relationship end when the playing career ends?
I'm still friends with a lot of them. You know, Facebook certainly helped that. All social media helped that. And but one of my clients I had years ago that was one of my favorite guys of all time, Stephen Chapman with the Brewers. I saw Stephen this year. I got to bring him to an Indian game, so he got to see Brantley, who was his roommate. In West Virginia, and Chapman's a fireman now, and we're friends. It's cool, but you know, he's a guy that didn't get to the big leagues and got released by the Brewers. I got him signed by the Reds, got the Double-A, and that was it. So, I mean, those stories suck, but the big league ones are tough because, you know, they would still be playing and probably being an integral part of the ball club if he was healthy. If he never got hurt, he'd be making a lot of money right now, and that's a tough thing to reconcile, and he's going to have to live with that, and he didn't do anything wrong. He just got hurt.
Yeah, that's a shame. And how do you deal with that? Because like you say, it wasn't physical talent. It was, you know, your body didn't hold up for you.
Yeah, his body didn't hold up, and it had nothing to do with his ability. I mean, he was really, really good. I mean, he was one of the better ground ball pitchers in the major leagues when he was healthy. And I had a few guys. I mean, in the span of a year, I had, I think, four guys with big leagues, and I called it a day. David Herndon, Bobby Cassava, Zach Sonicky, and Herndon, Cassava, Sonicky, and Brown. So that's four guys with big leagues in the last 2 years that just called it a day because of injuries, all four of them.
Yeah, such a big part of the game, and I don't know what we're going to do about it, but it I hate the phrase, but it is what it is. So.
Yeah, it's exactly what it is.
Yeah. I did want to get your take. I know you had a really interesting experience with Deadspin, maybe not recently, but you know, a little while ago, that I wanted you to just kind of tell the story of your first appearance in Deadspin.
Yeah, I check Deadspin every day, make sure none of my clients and myself are not on it, and probably more likely I'd be on it. And I was reading it a while ago, and halfway through it, the article about a general manager's value in relation to a ball club, if they're worth like an all-star player, depending on the GM. I think they used Billy Dean as the test on what he was actually worth to the ball club. I'm reading this article, it's about 9 pages, and halfway through it, there's a paragraph that starts off with, according to MLB agent baseball expert Josh Pokuznik, people are willing to take entry-level jobs in baseball because they love the sport, and there's going to be no shortage of people trying to get into the game. And I was like, what the hell? I was like, well, that, you know, we all lost that bet on what I was going to end up on Deadspin for the first time, because, you know, I thought I was going to get cited, you know, anyone thought I was going to be cited as an expert for the first time on Deadspin, I don't think anyone would have gotten that correct.
Yeah, being anonymously quoted in something you didn't say on Deadspin, yeah, that wouldn't have been the way I would have guessed, right?
No. So I got put on Deadspin for being an expert in that, and I tweeted the guy who wrote the story. And I'm like, you know, you could have emailed me or called me, you know, I'm very accessible. And he's like, oh, I loved your article, and I used it in my college, my thesis paper, my what did I say it was?
Oh, it's it like his collegiate or his college, not thesis, but what's
not his doctorate, his, it was something. We recorded it, we can plug it later.
Yeah.
But yeah, he used it for like his college thesis, and it was like, oh my god, sorry, like, I, why? So that was jarring. Like, I really can't get my brain around somebody using one of the BC articles, you know,
Yeah, I guess at least it was a good quote. You know, I mean, it was accurate.
Oh, yeah, it was fine, I think. It was such a... I hate to minimize its impact. It was such a throwaway article to me. Like, that was a throwaway article. And, you know, sometimes you have to keep putting content out. I mean, granted, it's good, I think, but it wasn't, like, you know, a game-changing, hard-hitting topic. It was just fluffy. And
I also find it interesting that he needed to quote somebody for such a... pretty straightforward. I think everybody who would read that kind of an article would understand, well, yeah, there's a lot more supply than a lot more demand.
Yeah, it seemed incredibly odd that he needed a citation for that, much less me. And it was very surprising because it wasn't a memorable article for me, and I didn't remember writing it.
Why would you quote somebody who works in, you know, on the baseball side of things with that quote rather than you? I mean, that's
I'm on the opposite side. Like, I'm not in hiring for sales. Like, I'm an agent. Like, he wasn't even talking about like trying to get in the agent business. It was purely an objective look at getting a job in baseball. Period.
I mean, he should have had a scouting. He should have had a scouting director with that quote or something. I mean, at least that would have made sense.
Well, it was just funny because I think that article lambasted people that, you know, the one I wrote was lambasting people that, you know, go to work in baseball because they say they love the game and then they work for, you know, $18,000 a year. But no, why are you doing that?
Right.
So it was strange. I've never been quoted before in an article that I didn't remember. Usually, you know, it would be the teenage reporter wanted to go to, and then some of the Jeffers stuff, and definitely some of the Brantley and other player stuff that I've written. So
yeah, I can't believe your first appearance on Deadspin isn't attacking a 16-year-old quote unquote reporter on Twitter.
Yeah, like how did that not get on Deadspin? And then, you know, I'm sure Deadspin doesn't know I'm alive, so that's good. But
that's a double-edged sword. It's like you want people to know that you're alive for the fame, but you don't want them to know that you're alive.
Oh, it's not a double-edged sword. That can only go one way. I've only been on it once, and I was surprised, and my wife was confused that she knows of Deadspin very well because of me. And thankful that I didn't get on Deadspin for the reasons that, like, Brett Favre got on Deadspin.
Well, thank God. And you know, I wouldn't...
Well, fortunately, that would be impossible because I'd never done anything that stupid. So, that's good.
Yeah, so you got that going for you, which is nice.
Yeah, I told you, I'm from your generation. We don't send texts with that stuff in it. What the hell are you thinking? And then Brett Favre is older than us, so what the hell was he thinking?
Yeah, that's just... it. There's no positive coming out of that move.
Not that I want to linger on this point at all. But the,
correct, yes.
The woman in the Favre story was a woman I went to college with.
Oh, yeah, Jen Sturger, right?
I went to college with Jen. Weird.
Did you know her at all? Like, way, but, like, knew who she was kind of thing?
No, I knew Jen.
I mean, it's a huge-ass campus is why I was asking, you know.
No. She hung around the baseball field all the time. You know, that was her thing. So, her all the time. I knew Jen. One of my old interns is dating her. So I saw her all the time. And what's funny is she's friendly with a mutual friend of mine who works in baseball. And she does the winter meetings every year. It's the weirdest thing ever.
Okay, you know, I got to ask. What kind of gal was she in college?
She was nice.
Got it. And she hung around the baseball field. All right, got it.
And the football stadium.
Yeah. All right. I'm starting to get a little clearer picture of what you're saying. Yep, got it.
We have to edit this part out, but she's...
All right, Josh, I guess that's a decent place for us to stop this week. It's been kind of a hectic week, you know, recording session this week. So before we get out of here, where can people find you on Twitter, email you if they want to email you, and all that good stuff?
I am at Joshua Kuznick on Twitter. I am on Baseball Perspective, under my name. You can just click the link to all my articles.
Your article last week was, I think, one of your best, if not your best. I really enjoyed that one.
I appreciate that. That was a good story to write. I actually thought I started it off better than I ended it. I liked forgetting when I see that I was in South Beach with a major leaguer and talked about how boring it was.
Well, blame your editor for that one, you know.
Yeah, well, it was boring, but got a job to do. So, I mean, it was a good trip. It was fun, but we didn't go to, like, Mountain Blue or Party or anything.
Or awesome. Rachel's, yeah.
Yeah, well, never Rachel's, ever. But I'm married and don't do that anymore, so that's good.
Yeah.
So it was just a work trip, and the story was fun. I liked that article. I actually would probably remember that article far more than the one I was citing on Deadspin. I seriously don't even remember writing it. And the funny thing is, that guy used it in a college dissertation, like you said.
Yeah.
And
there's the word we were looking for, dissertation. Yeah.
He used it in a college dissertation, and I probably wrote that article wearing my boxer.
Hey, I'm amazed that you were wearing clothes, so that's a good start, you know.
It's like that Simpsons line. Like, my wife always says, are you wearing, not wearing pants? It's like, oh, yeah, my bad.
Oops. Sorry about that.
Yeah, it's like the Lionel Hutz where, by the way, my favorite Lionel Hutz thing ever, because I like to segue pop culture as much as humanly possible, is, are you a Simpsons fan at all?
I am, yeah. Not a major one, but I'm a Simpsons fan.
It's horrible and unwatchable for the last 17 years, but before that, it was the best show ever.
Yeah, season 10 and before were great.
Yeah, so there's a scene with Lionel Hutz, Rachel Hartman, and Bart goes in with Homer to his law office with a coupon, and he was trying to get Lionel Hutz to do a legal case, and the advertisement to the Yellow Pages said, contingency, no money down, and Lionel Hutz, Phil Hartman, he's like, oh, that must have been an error at the print shop. And then he takes a pen and fixes it, and it says, contingency, ? No, comma, money down. Money down, exclamation point. And he's like, no contingency. He goes, yeah, money down. And he's like, what's this Bar Association logo doing in the top corner? And that's my favorite sight gag ever on The Simpsons, and they always try to, like, recapture that. By the way, I was so depressed watching the season premiere yesterday. I had to shut it off midway through. Homer had narcolepsy last night and had an affair with Lena Dunham. Like, ooh. Just kill the show. Just kill the show.
Yeah, not that it hadn't jumped the shark, but that's definitely a jump the shark moment. All of a sudden, when Lena Dunham is the female of his eye. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, for somebody as comfortable as she is in her skin, allegedly, it was odd to see her character on The Simpsons being this typical Simpson-y, attractive, skinny-weight, you know, woman. And it's like, it doesn't look like Lena Dunham at all. So comfortable with herself, but yet, magically, her first opportunity to not be herself, she took it.
Yeah, funny. She looked like one of the other eight hot girls on the show. Yeah, it's funny how that worked.
I don't care. I got no problem with Lena Dunham. Like,
and she's very funny. I'm just, like you say, yeah.
But what I'm saying, I don't like her that much. Like, she is funny. I don't think she's that funny. Like, I think Charlize Theron is actually a billion times funnier than her. If you've ever seen Charlize Theron, like, do SNL with those garbage writers that they had, always hilarious, and she was in that Million Ways to Die in the West that wasn't a very good movie, but it was hilarious, and she was great in it, and it's like, you know, there's plenty of, I mean, Kristen Wiig, and there's tons of funny women out there, Maya Rudolph, and just tons of them that came through SNL, and then...
Oh, God, Amy Schumer is hilarious, absolutely.
Yeah, Amy Schumer's show is incredible, and I don't even like Amy Schumer's stand-up, and her show is incredible, you know, it's like, okay, Lena Dunham, we get it, you're really edgy, and it's like, then Amy Schumer comes out, and it's like, well, Amy Schumer is way funnier than Lena Dunham.
I saw Amy in do stand-up, and she was hilarious. I mean, she was really, really good.
I've seen her do stand-up, I've seen her destroy an audience when they tackle her, because she plays the idiot blonde role so well. There is one thing my wife, though, has against Amy Schumer, because Amy Schumer, I don't know if this is like a meta-gag, but I don't know anything about women's clothing, fortunately. And Amy Schumer goes on Twitter regularly saying she's proud to be a size 6.
And then every time my wife sees her, it's like, there's no way she's a size 6.
Yeah, there's zero chance she's a size 6. Zero.
Because I Googled what a size 6 was, because I didn't know it, and I'm like, there's no way.
No. I mean, she's an attractive woman, and I don't want to say it that way, but she's not a size 6.
Right. No,
and
she
I
is,
cannot
but...
believe we're arguing this on a baseball podcast. This is hilarious.
I'm just saying, though, with Amy Schumer, though, again, not to get on this subject, but I am. She's awesome. Why would she even bring that up? Who cares?
Yeah. That's actually a great play. That's a great point.
So to tie a bow on it, Lena Dunham did what Amy Schumer basically does. Like, I'm skinny and pretty, I'm a Simpson. Like, oh, good. You look exactly like Natalie Portman, Danny. Except in real life, you don't really look like her.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, again, for another segue, I watched that first movie she ever did over the weekend with my wife, The Professional, and God, that movie was awesome.
Was it good?
Well, I've seen it a billion times.
Jean Reno's in it,
but the question I wanted to ask, because I know you're not a big movie guy, though, how has Gary Oldman not won an Oscar ever?
He's been in so many good movies, and like you say, I'm not a movie guy at all, but I mean, God, he's one of the guys I could actually recognize. Yeah, he should shoot.
If you ever watch anything, then I can, I guess, go on this, but my favorite Gary Oldman role of all time, and I'm saddened that Quentin Tarantino did not direct it, but Tarantino wrote the movie through him, and I don't know if anybody's ever seen it. I've seen it a bunch of times, but it's a Quentin Tarantino script, and Gary Oldman plays a white pimp who has one eye and a very ethnic accent, and it is one of the most striking, unintentionally hilarious, like, great scenes ever in a movie. And if anybody else was playing that role, you could, you know, it would have been borderline offensive. Maybe, like,
right. Maybe not even borderline.
Gary Oldman,
yeah.
Gary Oldman just, like, twice, and you're like, oh my God, this is awesome. And he just killed it. And it's sort of like when he was in The Fifth Element, Oldman, he played Jean-Baptiste Emmanuel Zorg, which is one of my favorite villains ever. And he was, again, that could have been a really cartoony, stupid role. And yeah, he elevates everything he does. I love Gary Oldman and everything. Even as Commissioner Gordon in the Batman movie, which, again, could have been a really terrible, idiotic role. And,
that's right. I forgot he did that. That's right.
And he was great. He was fantastic. Yeah. So, like my list of people who've never won an Oscar that shocked me were Peter O'Toole from Lawrence of Arabia, and Gary Oldman, and of course the one we disagreed on earlier, Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah. Jeez.
And maybe I can segue into that Titanic comment I made earlier, where I said it was a 3.5-hour Zales commercial, but with less emotional depth.
Definitely that's less emotional depth. Definitely more shallow. Definitely, for sure.
Yes, it was a 3.5-hour Zales commercial with less emotional depth.
Or range. Nice.
That's a good joke. I gotta do stand-up one day again.
I liked it, and that's
a perfect way to
take us out.
I was going to say, though, to be fair, I don't know how I would segue in a Titanic joke in 2015.
Yeah, I mean, that would be a little, it's a little bit of a dated joke, but I like it.
Yeah, I'll just throw that in there with my Joey Buttafuoco and O.J. Simpson, Kato Kaelin.
Oh, so your contemporary work.
And I'll throw in some jokes about the impending labor stoppage of 1995 or the one that's going to happen next year. Yeah.
Maybe you should write some about, you know, New Coke, too, so you can really be relevant.
That would be awful.
So, all right, on that note, I think we're going to get out of here for this episode.
Well, if there's any children listening, just remember what Johnny Dakota said. There is no hope with dope.
Johnny Dakota gave Zach his jacket to sell for the auction, and then all of a sudden Zach's like, I'm keeping this. Oh,
I want his leather jacket.
I still want Slater's bomber jacket that he won when Screech could see
when
the future.
I hate that we're dragging this on more, but do you remember when Zach's like, you smoke pot at a party. I don't want your jacket anymore. What?
Yeah, right, exactly.
Well, oh, my God. Wait, to further segue and have this be even more nonsensical, I was watching a rerun of Growing Pains the other day.
Show me that smile.
Yes. Well, I have them all DVR'd. I love watching Growing Pains. And Kirk Cameron was at a party with his two friends. The guy who played Chekhov's son was Boner. And the other friend, I forgot his name. And they all went to this party because they ran into some guy who used to be at their high school, but now he's in college. And they all go to this house party. And at the house party, this attractive blonde woman girl walked up to them. And holy God, it was Christy Swanson from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. It was her first role, like her second role, like ever. And the whole episode was like right in the heart of the Reagan years. And it was all about what a loser Mike was for not doing coke in the bathroom. And I'm like, and I'm telling you, I was so like detached from reality watching Kirk Cameron fight with himself about doing cocaine. And, you know, he tells his dad about it, but there was cocaine and I didn't do it. And now everyone thinks I'm a loser. It's like, excellent screenwriting. And the best part of the whole episode is Christy Swanson's character kept trying to force drugs on people. And in my experience being around drug addicts, they don't usually try to force people to take their drugs.
Yeah, they don't normally into sharing.
Yeah, she's like, you're not a loser, are you? We're going to do this cocaine. And they're like, what if your parents find out? Oh, I got it from them. What?
Impossible.
It's like I took it from the room. It was like, wow, are you just going to fit in? I learned it from watching you commercial. Please don't hashtag this cocaine at all, please.
Yeah, no. I don't. This is unbelievable.
My wife would leave me, and no one wants that. I don't want to pay for a house I don't live in.
Yeah, right. You don't want to pay for two houses. You only need to pay for one.
No, I'd be paying for one house I don't live in, and I would be in the street. Yeah. I'd be living at Marlins Park begging for change.
Or maybe at their GCL complex, anyways.
We didn't even get to touch on, maybe we'll do that next time. We didn't get to touch on my last Marlin game where I got to hang out with Pauly Shore.
Oh, God, that's right. I saw that tweet.
That part of it, and then we'll save it really.
Speaking
for
of
real
something
for
with
time.
Less emotional range than the Zales commercial.
Well done.
Thank you. All right.
The best part of that was literally all six people in the stadium didn't realize who Pauly Shore was.
Well, he has been kind of irrelevant for, I don't know, 25 years now.
I set you up for that. He was wearing a jersey with his name on it.
I mean, ever since Rockin' Jock was off the air, he's had a little bit of a slow career.
I was waiting for him to literally start telling people, I was an Encino man.
I'm the Weasel. Oh, did I lose you?
The best part of the Pauly Shore thing was he was hanging out with the executive producer of HBO show Ballers. And it was like, what?
You are the opposite of a baller.
And the guy was really, really nice to me. And we had a mutual friend in town and he worked in baseball. And he's like, yeah, if any of your clients wanted to be on Ballers, and I'm just thinking down the client list, I'm like, nope. Can't think of anyone who would do that. That would be a bad idea.
I can't think of one person.
No, I can think of everyone who would do it. I can't think of anyone that would be a good idea for.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, he was asking me, he's like, you know, maybe, you know, one of your clients come on, you need an extra, and I'm like, I don't want to be on Ballers. Then I'll be on this thing. And then this would lead to this awful spiral of me talking about how awful my career is, when really underneath it all, it's probably all I really wanted.
Well, and that also leads into one problem. You'd be forced to watch the episode of Ballers.
Have you seen the worst? That's like worst Jerry Maguire. It's worst Jerry Maguire. It's like if Jerry Maguire was written in crayon.
It wasn't already?
I like Jerry Maguire, except for, you know, 90% of the movie.
It's horrible. The movie is horrible.
Well, it's true to life, just like Ballers is. That's how agents interact with their clients.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, cush.
We totally need to talk about that one day, the portrayal of agents in pop culture, because
Bob Sugar says. Yeah, Bob Sugar was the best.
Oh, I told you, my best friend does that. And when we were in our 20s, and we were both single, and, you know, first question, what do you do? I'm a sports agent, like Jerry Maguire. And I still get that from people. And my friend would always be there, and my friend's like, "You're just like Bob Sugar." I'm like, "You fool."
Yeah, thanks for blowing up my spot, bud. So
I'm like, I kind of like Jay Moore, where I'm pretending to be a sports agent and I'm a failed stand-up comic.
I like Jay Moore, actually.
I'm indifferent to Jay Moore because I don't like his Christopher Walken impression as much as I like Bill Hader's Christopher Walken impression. But
so you're much like Hollywood. You're indifferent to Jay Moore. Gotcha.
Well done.
Thank
we're
you.
We're just hating on Jay Moore today.
I don't even know. I like the guy. So
we're just attacking poor Jay Moore, who gave me free entertainment laps on Saturday Night Live for half a season.
Yeah, maybe even a third. It was nice.
I think he was on it shorter than Sarah Silverman.
People forget that she was even on it, is how short Silverman
was on. She was on the interim cast between Harley and Hartman's cast and Will Ferrell's cast. And he was on that in-between cast that had Norm MacDonald, Adam Sandler, him, and it was just like, what is this?
Mm. Unbelievable.
All right, let's get out of here. I got to go back to real life.
Yeah, me too. So with that, say goodbye, Josh.
See you later. I don't know what the hell this was, but have fun editing.
Yeah, this should be a lot of fun. So I am Ryan Sullivan.
It will be.
At NatsGM.com on Twitter, reminding you, if you don't have the dollars, you better have some sense.